Thank you very much, Paul. It's a very great pleasure to be here and to have such a response to come on a time in a time of the quarter when I know things must really be starting to pile up. You have to realize, spent about 8 or 9 years of the joyful calling of being able to walk through the door of a classroom with a stack of books and paper under my arm like this, and open my mouth and start talking and have about 20 or 30 people who really, really had to listen to me. You know? And for the last 18 months, I walked through a door into a room with a stack of paper under my hand, and if I get a chance to talk, there's no guarantee that, well, I won't go into that. But it is also one of the things that I have less of now that I am serving in an administrative capacity, is, you know, really good interaction, I guess, in the world of ideas, where we can talk about theology or a particular passage or a particular theme, and have a kind of a commonality to start with, because we've been working on whatever, Galatians or 2 Thessalonians or something, for some weeks together, and we can come in and sit down and dig into a passage and pick up from things that were said last class period or two class periods ago. And that kind of questioning, response, seeing people hear what you're saying and being somewhere confident that they're really understanding it, you know, that's one of the great joys of teaching, if not the greatest, I think. And it's one of the things that really helps a person in his own study and scholarship to keep growing. And that kind of thing, you know, a professor at seminary is just blessed to have all kinds of it. And I'm not utterly without it. I would not have you think that it's impossible to carry on a conversation about theology at the corner of Lindbergh and I-44, but I am thirsty for it. In other words, I had such an appetite for it built up during my time here that I'm thirsty for it, and for that reason too, I'm always glad to have invitations like this to come and really, I hope, not lecture, but get into a good conversation on some theological points. And I encourage you to stop me with a question or to make me say what I said in that pithy, concise language that you didn't understand, you know, in a way that you do understand it or whatever. Don't hesitate to break in like that. Paul and I talked about a topic or something that could be, you know, touted or publicized, and he said, "Why don't you do something in the neighborhood or the area of what this publication from CPH is about, Reclaiming Patterns of Pastoral Ministry, Jesus and Paul?" And then we talked again a few days later, and I just hadn't come up with a title, and no snappy thing. Even the title of this book is hopelessly pedestrian, and I want you all to know it's not the title I gave it. CPH came up with this one. Mine was Paradigms of Ministry. They were frightened that people would see the word paradigms and either not know what it was or remember that it had something to do with Greek grammar and flee from it. So at any rate, I think that
probably the same editor who got a hold of Franz's hand.
We won't get into that. Well, they were confident that it'd be able to be marketed so much more successfully under this title, but There's a story to that, too. You're supposed to get the royalty checks, such as they are, twice a year. And however, if the sum total you are owed is under a certain level, then they don't bother in the month that it comes up, and you wait another 6 months. And that's what happened last time around. So we're not seeing a great marketing blitz on this one either. However, I hope it will not for too much longer continue to be a well-kept secret. And I thank your program committee for the opportunity to hold it up in front of you and talk a little bit about it. Some of you may have actually read in it already a little bit. I would set before you some of the basic premise. I don't know. I see a couple people have a copy or two, but I think I better not presume too much in terms of your understanding of how this is put together. The slogan verse, let us say, the pretext, which also becomes the thematic verse for one of the chapters, is 1 Corinthians 11:1, where St. Paul says, become imitators of me, even as I myself also am of Christ. Become imitators of me. Mimetai, mimetes is the word, and the verb is the deponent mimelmai. Imitators of me, even as I myself am of Christ. And although in 1 Corinthians there is an application that embraces all the members of the church in Corinth in that particular context, there is also in Paul's teaching and theology a setup by virtue of which he says things to Timothy, set yourself up as a model to the flock. And even in the 1 Corinthians passage, the Corinthians are encouraged to become mimetai, imitators of Paul, in a context where they themselves have become somewhat wayward. And again, Timothy is pointed to as a faithful son and an obedient son, whom Paul indeed is going to send to them in order to teach them and advise them and counsel them about living in the freedom of the gospel and responsive to the will of God as that is modeled in Paul's life himself. The from that pretext verse or that particular phrase and slogan, we build up in the introductory chapter a discussion of a certain kind of chain, a chain from Christ to the apostles to servants in the ministry in the days after the apostles. There's only one generation can provide apostles to the church, but after the apostles are gone, there are those who serve in the office of the public ministry in the chain of the apostles, and we call it the prophetic and apostolic tradition. Now, that particular chain, we suggest, has both modeling and imitating about it. And there is substance, there is content that is handed along down that chain. There is the content or the substance of representation or authority. The very word apostolos, and we work on that a little bit in that opening chapter and point to the idea of the one sent being as the one who sends him, and the ways in which this is an office of authoritative representation, so that when the apostles are sent out, they are sent out to be persons through whom the ministry, the work, of Christ himself is extended. That's shown in the anticipatory chapter of Matthew 10 already, and then likewise in the post-resurrection situations where John 20, Matthew 28, and with the call of Paul himself. Now, that apostolic representation, you see, is one of the points. Another substantive point in this chain of tradition is servanthood. We talk about Jesus' self-understanding as the suffering servant, and the way in which that then becomes content, substance, that fills the understanding of what an apostle and what a servant in the office of the public ministry is. And then we talk about the Spirit and say that what's going on is not simply a matter of setting an example, but with this charge to be an authoritative representative goes also the gift of power to carry it out. And so when we talk about, you know, when we get down to talking about servants in the office of the public ministry, we're not laying on a bunch of people a lot of law talk to set up some ideal that's back there from the past and is taught and given to us, but which is somehow unattainable. But since part of the one of the things that is transmitted in the chain is not only the example to be imitated and not only the servant substance of it all, but the Spirit himself who continues, who is that other counselor and through whom Christ's ministry is continued as it is incarnated in each generation, there's a cause for some comfort and some hope. We're not up against some kind of humanly impossible task, you see. So that's sort of the basic premise of the thesis, if you will, that is laid out then in the book. A couple of the more, I don't know what I want to say, I guess provocative things, thrusts in here. Let's see, I made myself a couple notes because I can't always remember exactly where I said and dealt with everything. But I want to start with some of the things that are on pages 29 and 30. Feature something that's in the footnotes at that point. This book does have footnotes in it. They're not footnotes. They're endnotes, which is probably a good idea because they're hidden that way and people don't open the book and see all the footnotes and say, I don't want to buy that. It looks too hard. But back in the back are the endnotes, which is also then not a good idea because you got to keep paging back and forth. So I don't know the best way to lay those out, but the 29 and 30 doesn't sound right. Where am I here? Chapter 2, chapter 3, pages 29 and 30. I'm also starting to have trouble with my glasses, so you know, my memory and my eyes are going at the same time, and this is trouble. Now I'm gonna find it now, I think. I thought maybe the a way to get us into this was to get this a little closer to me here and we'll know what we're doing. We hope. In chapter 3, at note 62, and I believe that corresponds to about pages 42 and 43. Now, let me get this right here. At the conclusion of the second main chapter, we set forth, maybe I should back up with about two sentences to set the stage on this. After that opening chapter, which lays out the premise, we talk about the parent and child as one of the paradigms, so that we try to understand under the fatherhood of God as the source of life and the one to whom honor and obedience is due, there is also a role of the apostle in relationship to his converts, by virtue of which the apostle talks about himself as the father who begets the believers through whose ministry, who come to faith through his ministry. Or in one case in Galatians, Paul talks about, oh, you Galatians, whom I bear amid throes of birth pangs. And he uses a mothering, a giving birth metaphor to talk about his teaching and ministry by which the Galatians become believers. The second chapter picks up on the idea of life and death, which we turn around into death and life. Ever since the fall, that's the order of things. The ministry of Christ and of those who serve in his ministry is ministry that starts with death as the reality of things and moves through the death to the life. We discussed at length in the third chapter, the second thematic chapter, two passages where Paul talks about the service of the apostolic level of ministry in this way. The first is 2 Corinthians 4:12, but the death is at work in us and the life in you. And we make a point in there that the two articles in there should probably not be taken as generic, that is to say, death is at work in us, but life in you, but ha thanatos and he zoe, the death of Christ, and the life of Christ. And that the difference between the apostle, the apostolic we in that passage, the first person, and the congregational second person in that passage, is one that doesn't divide them, you know, and make them be in two different realms, but recognizes the oikonomia, the way in which God has set up that the ministry be done. The second passage that we take on in that chapter then is Colossians 1:24, where Paul says, I fill up from my side the sufferings of the Christ for the sake of his body, the church. And that's a tough passage, and we make a few remarks about whether it should be taken in a sense. In what sense can Paul say that he fills up the hysteremata, the things that are not there to create fullness of the afflictions of the Christ? There's the possibility of the mystical union, because Paul is in Christ and Christ in Paul. In the mystical union idea, you can talk about Paul's afflictions being Christ's afflictions. There's the suggestion of the messianic woes idea, that before the end of the age comes, a certain number of woes, like with the plagues in Egypt, before the great deliverance happens, there's a certain number of woes and sufferings must take place, and that by suffering, Paul helps history move closer to that great day of deliverance at the end. And then there is the one that I proposed that ties in with the interpretation I put in there of 2 Corinthians 4:12, and that is the apostolic ministry one, that there is in between Easter and the parousia a historical incarnation of what has been accomplished for once and for all. And the preaching of the word of the cross and the ministry that is worked out in the life of the apostle, who is a suffering apostle under his suffering Lord, coincides in this way. And that's the sense of the thrust of those two passages when you set them side by side. Now, the provocative thing, you know, and I'm I'm leading you right to the place where I can probably be roasted on this, if anywhere. It's not the bland part of the book. Starts on page 43, where we suggest that some things about the ministry with regard to this. If you'll endure me reading a paragraph or two, and then look at the little design back on the footnote at 62, that'll make the basic point that I want to get out in front of you at this point. Such an interpretation of these passages leads toward the vision of a great mystery about apostolic service, and therefore also about the ministry. It has to do with the proclamation of the cross in the life and sufferings of the preacher, as well as in his words. It has to do with the relationship of the events of salvation to the proclamation of the events of salvation. It has to do with the working out now, in the historical situation of the interrelatedness of preacher, gospel, and hearers, those eschatological realities accomplished in Christ. It has to do with the ongoing process between resurrection and parousia of God working that which he wrought in Christ. It has to do with God at work to save in Christ through the gospel ministry of his apostles, a ministry of Jesus extended beyond the bounds of his earthly life. Perhaps an analogy from the Old Testament will be helpful to set forth this vision. Sacrifice and bloodshedding are part of the typological prefigurement of the sacrifice of Christ and the redemption won once for all by him on Calvary. Nonetheless, those sacrifices are for sin, and were carried out as such by God's command at a particular time and place. They had no meaning apart from the one eternally valid sacrifice for sin, but in connection with Christ, they did carry the power of the atonement won by him. Similarly, as regards the prophetic ministry in the Old Testament, it's customary to speak of the sufferings of Jeremiah, as one example, as typologically prophetic. See Jeremiah 20. So also the sufferings of an apostle may be typological, not typologically prophetic, but typologically imitative, pointing not forward, but backward to the Christ. But some of the same kind of attempt to not see this as a shallow thing, but as a deep level of God at work in time, doing that which is the eschatological event through ministry and the ordinances which he has commanded to be done. You see, the same kind of thing that we talk about with regard to typology in the sacrificial system and all the other institutions of the Old Testament, turn that right around and talk that way about apostolic imitation. And if it's true then of apostles, it's also true of their successors, Timothy, and all the rest, all the way down to us. And so some artist at CPH drew this little diagram here on page 116 about typology and imitation. Typology covering the sacrifices and the lives of the prophets pointing forward to Christ, sufferings and the lives of the apostles and those in the ministry, under the name of imitation, pointing backwards to Christ, which then you know, leads then on into the next paragraph on page 44. This means that the ministry itself is sacramental in nature in the New Testament period, even as the this-worldly elements of the cultus and ministry in the Old Testament period were typological bearers of the power of God to save that would be revealed in the incarnate Christ. Pastors are human beings set aside by divine institution to be channels, proclaimers in word, deed, and in sufferings of the word of the gospel of the crucified Christ. The sufferings of such set-aside men are the afflictions of the Christ. They participate in, typologically reveal, imitate, and so represent in a given time and place that which was accomplished at Calvary on Good Friday for all times and places in Jesus Christ. Therefore, apostles are not exactly the same as those who are not apostles. They have been singled out and given a specific role in God's plan of salvation, in the oikonomia, in the ordering of the affairs of the household. And they have also been given the corresponding authority and responsibility of their office, the exousia. And it's hard not to translate exousia with authority and responsibility together. Similarly, men in the ministry set aside also are not in every respect just like laymen. There can be no confusion. Peter is not Christ, and Paul is not Jesus, and a pastor is not equal to the Lord, but those in the ministry are designated leaders, targets for the world, lightning rods to the opposition, consecrated servants, mediators of the gospel, and preachers of the Christ, of the crucified Christ in word, deed, and suffering. Theirs is a calling that imitates the pattern set by Jesus, so brings into being in historical situations between resurrection and parousia the truth of the message of the one love that gave itself into death so that others might live. This gives a far deeper meaning to the word imitation, and it goes on. I won't belabor it more with that. So I've got you know a few more areas we could go into, but I think that sets in front of you one of the key ideas in the book as we've tried to extract it from a vision of the institution of the ministry in there. Yeah. Good. I'm glad we got a question. You see, usually that's my method, right? Talk, and if nobody's asking questions, try to get more provocative and more provocative until we start getting them. Good.
David Skerr, in his most recent paper on the validity of sacramental functions carried out by women, comments on the imitation, is the pastor being a very real presence when he's speaking in the place and by the command of Jesus Christ, a very real presence of Jesus Christ, and argues then that this imitation, part of this imitation is our very maleness, you know, the fact that Jesus was male there also. Do you see this as being, you know, very, very much related to what you just said, this imitation? Is this an extension of the same line of thought?
Let me not comment on the maleness first, but as regards the basic point, yes, and it's I think, you know, reflected in something that's part of our liturgical doing and stems from the catechism with regard to the office of the keys, and one of the things that I think was absolutely brilliant by Dr. Nagel in the issue of the Concordia Journal last year was to talk about the doctrine of the ministry from the confessions by starting not with the Augsburg Confession articles 5 and 14 and so forth, but with the small catechism office of the keys, and that's very critical. And there, one of the questions and answers is in the form of confession, you know, do you believe that when I, the pastor, speak these words to you, they are as the words spoken by God himself? I mean, what more direct and bald-faced way can we be enacting the Jewish institution of the Shaliach? The Shaliach is as the one who sends him, you see. So, yes, with regard to the imitation and representation. With regard to the maleness, I agree with the basic point in Dr. Scare's article. I think he could have probably laid it out better in terms of orders, taxes, okay? And that, you know, that goes from God to the human being, and within humanity, it goes from male to female. So that, if you will, God and the people, are like husband and wife, right? What's the prophet? Hosea, you know, and also Christ and the bride, the church, you know. So likewise within human beings, male and female recapitulate that pattern, that relationship. And Paul lays that out. He lays it out. You know, the head of the woman is the man, and the head of the man is God. You know, so that there you have toxes,
so
orders.
You're saying that the head of the man is God. It would be the head of mankind.
Surely, but in so far as it gets worked out, God. You know, let's take Genesis 3 literally, huh? Seriously, you know. Up from the created good things comes the suggestion. There's the animal, the serpent, and the fruit that's there, and the woman. Temptation, you know, put them together, mix them together, what you got? Temptation and fall, sin. From the woman, you know, to the male human being. She gave it to him and he ate. It's coming up from the bottom. The suggestion to eat didn't come down from God. The command not to eat came down from God. The suggestion to eat arose from the bottom up. Once he ate, you know, now it's interesting. When Eve ate, God didn't come and say, Eve, where are you? Eve ate, gave to Adam. Once Adam ate, God came and said, not Adam and Eve, where are you? But Adam, where are you? And of course, Adam said, the woman you gave me, you know, and you know, you can't you see the toxase in there in the conversations, in the who talks to whom? See? Now, it's in that sense that we have a doctrine and a teaching in the Bible about male and female in the orders of creation, you know. And it's in that sense that as the apostolos, as the representative of God speaking to the people, as the representative of Christ, you know, giving ministry to the bride of Christ, there's something incongruous about it if that person doing that is a female. There's something wrong being modeled about it there. See? And it's an old tract, it's an old essay, but the one that lays this out best, if you haven't read it, is one by Peter Brunner. Peter Brunner, The Ministry and the Ministry of Women. It was he wrote it in German for Lutheran World or something, and CPH translated about, must be 20 years ago now, at least more maybe. About 58 or 60 or 64, I don't know when. You know when that? I don't know. It's. Yeah, it's old, but it makes this statement, you know, very, very clean and clear, and extracts it from biblical theology in a very good way. But yes, the idea that the one who presides over the family is in a certain sense in the place of Christ and the spokesman for God, and that this should imitate the kind of structure that obtains in terms of God's relationship to humanity and male to female within humanity, it all fits together. Good point. Long answer to a short question, sorry. Yes, sir, Charles.
I was going to bring up Mark Rowe, but I meant by the idea of the sacramental nature of education.
Well, sometimes how shall I say it? I'll answer that again. This is dangerous, you know. It's telling stories, but you know, you read a lot of things, you watch a lot of TV. It's a lot of it's pretty informative, but you hear a lot of sermons, you know, which are certainly a lot of them are good. But every once in a while, something, probably more because you're ready, you know, becomes very memorable because it just clicks at the moment. Now there was a series on one of the networks. See, I can't even remember which one, but I think Bill Moyers might have had something to do with it on the religions of man across the world. You know, and all 1 week they did Taoism and whatnot, and it was pretty good. It was kind of informative and all that. 1 week. They did Eastern Orthodoxy, you know, and in particular, they zeroed in on Romania for some reason, the Romanian Orthodox Church, and the narrator spent some time talking about the nature of their faith and their piety and all that, and he got into icons. And how the representational power in the icon is so much stronger in that kind of context of piety than just a picture is for us in a lot of ways. And after spending some time bringing the audience along and talking about, you know, this powerful representation and the image and the revelation itself that comes through these icons, he said something like this, "But boy, was I surprised to feel what it's like to be in the presence of a living icon, the bishop, who now is not a painted, but an incarnated icon, you see." And that really stuck with me. And there's a truth about what we're talking about in the ministry here, in that there it's not a modeling in a flat sense, but it's an incarnating in an imitation sense that goes deep. There's a very good book on the imitation idea by a Dutchman named De Boer, D-E-B-O-E-R, The Imitation of Paul, The Imitation of Paul. There are at least two of those De Boers, and I can't remember for sure. It's in there somewhere. It's in the back, I think. It's Peter, I think, isn't it? Yeah. There's Hendrik, and I think there are two Hendriks, in fact. But and he discusses the mimeomai concept, you know, all over the place in the Greek education and all kinds of things. But it really comes out to emphasize that we tend to think of imitation as a pretty cheap word, but it's really a very deep word, in that the imitation is not just on the surface, but it is an integrating and an adaptation and a way of conduct, you know, all the way down to become Christ-like, you know, to become a Christ to others. And we try to address it a number of times in here, you know, that there's a to grow and to be nurtured and to grow in sanctification, and to be challenged to be imitators of Paul, even as he is of Christ, and to, in fact, in Ephesians it says, be imitators of God, you know. And as we go along, we will be like him, 2 Peter, partakers of the divine nature, 1 John 3, then we shall see him as he is, and we shall be like him, we'll be his sons in perfection. All of those things are true for the entirety of the people of God. But we also try to focus on a number of passages in which there seems to be something special being said about those who serve in the office of the public ministry as representatives of Christ now here on earth to the people. There's a very, very strong quote of Bonhoeffer in one of Newhouse's forum letters from about 2 or 3 months ago that brings this out. I mean, you talk about provocative. This should get it going here. We're saying the same thing, but just saying it so pointedly, you know. I'll leave off with the context in which he chooses to quote this, which has to do with other things. What the church this is Bonhoeffer, he's quoting, what the church proclaims is the word of the revelation of God in Jesus Christ. This word does not proceed from any man's own heart or understanding or character. It comes down to man from heaven, from the will and the mercy of God. It is a word commanded and instituted by Jesus Christ, and from this it follows that the word, by the manner of its coming, establishes a clearly differentiated relationship of superiority and inferiority. Above, there is the office of proclamation, and below, there is the listening congregation. In the place of God and of Jesus Christ, there stands before the congregation the bearer of the office of preaching with his proclamation. The preacher is not the spokesman of the congregation, but, if the expression may be allowed, he is the spokesman of God before the congregation. He is authorized to teach, to admonish, and to comfort, to forgive sin, but also to retain sin. And at the same time, he is the shepherd, the pastor of the flock. This office is instituted directly by Jesus Christ himself. It does not derive its legitimation from the will of the congregation, but from the will of Jesus Christ. It is established in the congregation and not by the congregation, and at the same time, it is with the congregation. When this office is exercised in the congregation to its full extent, life is infused into all the other offices of the congregation, which can, after all, only be subservient to the office of the divine word. For wherever the word of God rules alone, there will be found faith and service. The congregation, which is being awakened by the proclamation of the word of God, will demonstrate the genuineness of its faith by honoring the office of preaching in its unique glory, and by serving it with all its powers. It will not rely on its own faith or on the universal priesthood of all believers in order to depreciate the office of preaching, to place obstacles in its way, or even to try to make it subordinate to itself. The superior status of the office of preaching is preserved from abuse and against danger from without precisely by a genuine subordination of the congregation, that is to say, by faith, prayer, and service, but not by a suppression or disruption of the divine order or by a perverse desire for superiority on the part of the congregation. Now, that's, you know.
This imitation of Christ isn't going on in the parish somewhere. What are people imitating? I mean, is there any particular kind of T-post out there?
I think we could take a poll on that. You know, I'm not an expert on that at all. this is time for discussion. Let's open it up for discussion on that question. Yeah, right.
Well, you sort of just answered that question, though, with your discussion on the sacramental aspects of the ministry. You know, so that we have no doubt about where Jesus is giving his forgiveness, he says, this body, and the this blood. And then with the water in baptism, it's this water connected with my word. And it's the same way, that sacramental aspect is there with the ministry. When you have people that have not been given to do it, but, you know, called and ordained to do it, you lose that assurance of where God locates his forgiveness. You don't have the same assurance. It's not that, maybe it's valid, but you don't have the same promise to grasp onto and be assured that forgiveness is located there at the hands of the pastor. And it seems that with just anybody doing it, the ambiguousness about it is unnecessary because God never intended us to be ambiguous about where his ministry or where his forgiveness is.
But I think the point to be made also is that the office of the ministry is the provision of the administration of the means of grace. However, I'm hard put to envision the administration of anything without an administrator of it, you know, and that's where the people being set into or designated or called and appointed to fill the office or to have the office entrusted to them. That's where they come in, and that's what keeps the kind of things I've been saying from becoming some kind of sacerdotalism with a caste or an ordo of people who are as regards their personhood made different from lay people. It is the call and the entrustment of the authority and responsibility that makes the difference. And that also then, you see, is the assurance to the congregation that they have followed Christ's will and word by having the ministry administered by an administrator of it in their midst, so that they can put their trust in the external means, as you were talking about. There was another two more hands. Good, yeah.
I guess a lot of this, when you talk about imitation being a sacramental thing, what I wonder about is imitation also for me seems to imply the idea or the area of behavior, whether I smile or don't smile, for instance, in a sermon, or whether I shake hands warmly or look at the next person who's coming through the line while I'm shaking hands with the first one. How are we talking about that also imitatively being a type of sacrament? Or I know when Luther comments on Peter's behavior with the Galatians, and he discusses that with him, he mentions that Peter, by his misbehavior, refusing to eat with Gentile Christians, injected a scruple into their mind that said that they had to become Jewish to be acceptable to God. And he did that simply by a behavioral act. Maybe words attended it, maybe they did not, but what he did was simply not sit down and eat with them in the cafeteria. Now, what I'm wondering is, the flip side of that issue is, if we talk about imitation in reference to behavior, how does my imitation also become a means of grace for the church? Or mean of instilling.
Yeah. I'm going to say a couple sentences, which will refer to the chapter in the book that talks about behavior, about conduct, you know, along these lines. But I'm not sure I'm going to address the concern at the root of it. In addition to this whole thing of, you know, the life and the death and the parent and the child and the divine jealousy and these other paradigms that we work out, we also say there is, in the matter of manifesting sanctified behavior, there is a paradigm there as well. And Paul, in several different contexts, holds himself up as a model of a particular kind of behavior that the Christians should be led to follow. The Thessalonians are told to become imitators of him in this sense, that he worked with his hands, you know, to see to the needs of his body, and he wasn't idle and disorderly, atactos, you know. The Corinthians are told, in the case of the strong and the weak, that the right kind of behavior is for the strong to give up their rights. And Paul's example is himself again. I had a right to take pay, and to eat bread gratis from people, but I didn't. You know, I worked for my living again. And so, giving up one's rights is a particular behavior pattern that is held up, and then that carries over into the whole sections in the pastoral epistles, which say the one to be set aside, who aspires to be set aside into these offices, is a person who should be above reproach in a whole list of different kinds of behavioral types of things. Now, that suggests, you see, that indeed, as you say, conduct and behavior can absolutely undermine the proclamation, or it can support it, and that's something I think that's, you know, said often and everything. But I'm not sure I've touched all the way to the depth of the concern that you're trying to get at.
So we talk in small card articles about a fifth means of grace being mutual conversation, consolation of brethren, and that seems mostly verbal. Yeah, Luther often. And I think that is thrust of that, is that it's verbal, or sharing of the word, and there are different fashions in which we do that. But Luther also, in his letters of spiritual counsel, oftentimes talks about, well, take the fellow out to go out and sing, stir up your spirits that way. Certainly that's in the context of the word, but how are those behavioral acts as imitative masks of Christ?
What I hear you saying is simply, you know, that there are a lot of ways to communicate with body language and a lot of other kinds of things in addition to verbal, and that all plays in, you know, that all plays in, but in terms of incarnating it, you know, so it's not the repetition of words.
Yeah, I appreciate letting yourself set off.
Yeah. Yes, sir, please. I forgot your name again. John, yeah, right.
In regard to the privileges and responsibilities of the offices of public ministry, what of those can a pastor delegate, if any? What can be delegated of those responsibilities and privileges? And I realize this question deals with the resolution that
yeah, right. That's what I was going to do, is tell you to read the CTCR document and the convention proceedings. No, I wrestle with that, because there's a difference between the exousia that is entrusted to the episkopos in the oikonomia, in the whole setup of the household. The overseer has an exousia. There's a difference between that and the particular things that he does, the functioning, the verbs. Okay? I always go back to a family, you know. The father sits at the head of the table, the mother sits at the other end of the table, the children on the sides, and the father carves the turkey. Okay? Now, if the father slips on the ice the day before Thanksgiving and breaks both his wrists and can't carve the turkey, well, for goodness sakes, the mother carves the turkey, but she doesn't sit in the father's place while she does it, and the children don't all call her father, you know. Now, you see, there are certain things to be done, and then there is a position and a responsibility. Now, let's see, we're not mixed company anymore, is that right, you see? We might discuss then what particular functions the father does that simply cannot be delegated, I prefer to talk in the area and on the level of the position entrusted to a person by virtue of his call, ordination, and installation in relationship, rather than to try to list out and sift out, you know, the kinds of things that only he can do and the others can't. Although, I think there are a couple of things that are pretty obvious. The presiding at the table for the family's meal. The delivery of the last word of decision and wisdom about the family's tradition. The judgment about rewards or punishments to the children. He can take in a lot of counsel, but he's the last word, you know. What have I said? You know, presiding at the Lord's Supper, overseeing the instruction, the teaching, being the fountainhead of the teaching, exercising jurisdiction. Let's talk some practical situation in Montana or something, with a four-point parish and one pastor, and and some lay assistants who deliver homilies or provide some guidance to the community as gathered there at various times during the week. A certain amount of that stuff is very natural. It's like the older sons in a family giving some guidance and advice to younger ones when the dad's off on the back 40 plowing and can't be asked what to do about the whatever, the pig who got his broken leg, or I don't know, you know. So, but all of that, you know, all of that's, I don't know, pigs don't get, but, you know, all of that kind of activity where the older brothers do things like that isn't undermining the basic position and responsibility and authority over the family that the father has. See, it's all done under his leadership, aegis, supervision, whatever you want to say. That a person, you know, a generation ago or two generations ago now, maybe I better start talking that way. it was a very hard thing for lay people in our circles to accept the idea of assisting in the distribution of the communion in any way, an elder, anybody in the church, you know. We even have to kind of encourage some people to touch the chalice, period, you know. See. Now, that's, you know, I think that's the kind of thing where what's happened in the passing of a couple generations can be seen to be all right, insofar as there's no understanding that the practices undermine the presiding office of the father of the family. But let the person come along who says, we don't need Dad at all. We can do all this after all. In fact, you know, Big Sister here has a stronger voice and is, to tell the truth, a little smarter than Dad anyway, you know, and makes a real nice sermon. So, you know, then you've lost it. So you got to remember the principles while you talk about the details. And that's why I like to envision the entrusted position of leadership and the responsibilities and the relationships that creates, and then go from there in terms of activities and functions. But back to you, John, on follow-up. Go ahead.
How about the situation where you would have a lay minister under the authority of a pastor, where a pastor is in one congregation and the lay minister is in another? Can he delegate, or can that lay minister do these things under his aegis properly?
Let me, you know, try to answer by paying no attention whatsoever to the resolutions of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, but just by the vision of it that I'm trying to come out of the scripture with. And that is simply that in the structuring of the order of the household, in the oikonomia, if the Gemeinde of that place, if the congregation of that place has in fact agreed, you know, to that kind of a setup, and that there has been a measuring of that layman who is going to do that kind of leading by peers in the ministry, you know, other servants who are stewards of the delivery of the word, I can see it as something that is not improper in terms of New Testament theology by virtue, frankly, of understanding that man to be called to have that position. It would be preferable, to bring us back to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, to have that person called and ordained as you are the first public group I'm laying this idea for terminology in front of, because every terminology somebody comes up with, somebody else doesn't like, whether it's deacon or whatever. But presiding local elder is going to be located there, and that community, you know, acclaims him. There being not an overseer able to be sent, an apostola somehow from the ministerium of the church to this place, let us nominate and have the church ratify our nomination, someone from amongst our midst who is among the presbyteroi of the place to be a presiding elder. He can't be called to the next town over, you know. Good Lord, I don't know whether he should be on the roster of Synod or not, but I think it would be probably wise. You know, I see, I'll pick up on Professor Schmelder's recommendation. You know, for the sake of the vision of orderliness across the church body, it would be wise to have him be, you know, educated and examined and certified, and therefore also rostered. But he's going to be resident, and in fact he may be a worker priest, you know, of some sort. But let's do it that way. What we're talking about doing when we say, okay, someone will be the lay minister in this place and will be under the aegis of a pastor somewhere else, is practically that kind of setup, and that's where I can see some legitimacy to it. But I'd prefer to get better terminology in there that would connect the idea of a person being nominated, examined, certified, called, entrusted, installed, appointed to do this instead of just, you know, whatever. So, Charlie.
Would this be envisioned as a temporary measure until a pastor, which is God's gift for a congregation, can be called, just so that the ministry of the word can take place to an extent more than it would if there were no pastor at all?
Well, I don't know. You could go either way on that, and I would be disappointed if congregations started saying, well, that's great, and we'll do that, and so the demand for pastors went down and down and down and down and down, and there weren't any who came to seminary anymore. You know, obviously that's not the goal, but I don't think that you would have to say that that this is some kind of stopgap emergency type of setup, nor do I think you should. You know, I'll try to refine what you said a little bit there, okay? God's gift to the congregation is the ministry, which is the administration of the means of grace, which is carried out by the local presiding elder, so-called. God's gift to the church is, you know, able and clear teachers and preachers of the gospel, who you know, we hope and believe and can affirm, you know, is one of the ways God is giving those gifts to the church is through the seminaries, you know, and having don't do that, and having men who are not local from the community up, but who are part of the ministerium of the church, coming to the congregation and making their life and giving their leadership there. That's a gift as well. But don't, you know, it'd be tough, you know. Inevitably, in human terms, we'd start to make comparisons, wouldn't we? And the congregations of a 3-point parish who didn't have the resident pastor might feel second rate or whatever. I don't know. Maybe they'd feel lucky too. I don't know. You know, so there's a joke about that, you know, about the not in the Lutheran tradition, but a church that when am I supposed to stop anyway? I presume people who have to study or something and just get up and go whenever. So, but there was a little church that was on the situation whereby they gave an annual contract to the man who served them in the ministry, and they were very famous throughout this little denomination for dismissing a man after 1 year's service and taking on a new one. And they had done this for about as far back as anybody could remember, 10, 20, 30 years, you know, and all that. And so, you know, a guy a lot like Paul here got that call and was engaged in everything to provide the ministry to that church for a year. And when it came down to the year's end meeting where they were going to decide what about next year and the contract and everything, he was pretty well resigned that he'd pack his bags and leave and have to look for something else or hope to be called. And lo and behold, for the first time in anybody's memory, they renewed his contract a second year. Super. He was really glad, you know, and didn't know what to say, but accepted and served another year and wondered what was going to happen at the end of that year. And lo and behold, they renewed it again. And he was just nonplussed and couldn't figure out how or why he was so much, you know, more desirable to these people and better than everybody else who'd been there for 1 year stands for all these years. And so his curiosity was up and he couldn't help but ask him. And then he asked, he said, you know, this group is famous, et cetera, and all that. You know, now a second year and a third year you're renewing. I'm just curious, you know, what is it about me that makes me different from all the others? Well, a little hemming and hawing, and one of the elders stood up and said, "Well, you see, Pastor, this little congregation here doesn't really want a pastor. And you're the closest thing to not a pastor that we've found." So there are lots of different ways in which that all works. So, Dave, yeah. Sorry.
I'm trying to connect this back to the paradigm of ministry between Jesus, apostles, pastors. And then to mix metaphors of the father cutting the turkey, I think right now what we're dealing with, which is saying it's kind of a polity question, almost we've got the office of the ministry is certainly not a polity question, but in the eyes of the church, we have the office of the ministry, pastor, the seminary system, and then perhaps these local elders or presiding elders. It's almost like we would still be a view of the presiding elder would be the older brother still cutting the turkey rather than the father. I don't know if we push the paradigm of ministry that we have.
Well, the thing is, you know, that all metaphors and analogies break down sooner or later, and you found the point at which that one breaks down, because you know, it's by the facts and accidents of birth that fathers and brothers and everything is, whereas ministers are made, priests are born and ministers are made, and they're made, however, by being called by God in Christ, but being called mediately through God's church. Now, you know, that's the tricky part of it, is that that's the reality. Those are the theological truths. When you are called and ordained and installed to be the pastor someplace, and that sets you in the seat and the relationships of father to the family. The unfortunate thing is, you know, the wonderfully fortunate thing is, I'll say the good news first, you know, and is that a lot of our congregations understand that very well. And my first call was to a wonderful church of people, good Christian people, who really helped finish my education as a pastor, and young as I was, and peculiar as I was, you know, accepted me and paid me the respect of the office the way, and it's a wonderful thing when it works. The unfortunate thing is that a number of our congregations see it otherwise, and you have the in that instance the unenviable task of being the one also charged to teach them about the way it really is. See? It's not unlike the whole business of the church growth, and the stranger comes into church and decides to choose to worship at this church, and sooner or later you hope that they come to see it the other way around, that they were chosen and called and made children of God. But, you know, there we're talking about you know, human beings and the social relationships and everything like that, and that's the, you know, that's an educative teaching task of theology in a practical situation. Do you want to? I'll be glad to stand or sit around and yammer with anybody who wants to continue, but maybe you should have a recognizable ending. I don't know how, you never told me how long this meeting was supposed to last.
Well, so. You professor types did.
Well, I warned you, you know, that I'm thirsty for this kind of interchange, so.
We'd like to thank Dr. Groth.